Morning, everyone. May you live in interesting times is a sardonic curse of uncertain origin. Similarly uncertain is what the next decade might have in store for policymakers and for participants in the financial system. What new risks might emerge, what their impact might be, and how they might interact. In the spirit of today's conference, I'll step back a bit from the conjunctural outlook to discuss some of the emerging challenges to global and domestic financial stability that could be with us for many years. To spare any suspense, I have two punchlines. First, the nature of the emerging risks we're likely to confront over the next decade have a different complexion to those of recent decades. Some of those risks could originate from within the financial system, including risk of rapid-fire deposit runs, spillovers from smaller entities that individually are not systemically important, and from higher interest rate volatility. Importantly, other emerging risks are emanating from outside the financial system, most notably geopolitics, operational risk, and climate change, and for which there's no historical precedent to guide us. If we are entering a decade laden with new types of risks, some of which could interact, the second main message is that we need to rethink the concept of resilience. It's entirely possible and even likely that regulation and supervision will need to adapt as the threat environment evolves. But the ultimate responsibility here lies with industry. There are limits to what even the most finely calibrated regulatory and supervisory regime can achieve when industry governance and risk management practices fall short. We have a shared interest in getting our collective response right. The first inside risk is that of rapid bank deposit runs in the digital age. Bank deposit runs are as old as banking itself. Much ink was spilled in the aftermath of the global financial crisis to reduce this vulnerability, but events abroad this year suggest there's more to do. Concerns over profitability and poor risk management have long been the catalyst for bank deposit runs. In this sense, the banking turmoil in the United States and Switzerland earlier this year was no different. But what was unprecedented was the speed of deposit runs. As a case in point, Silicon Valley Bank lost 30% of its deposit base in a matter of hours and had another 50% poised to be withdrawn the following day. In our current system, no bank can survive a run of that magnitude. It was far beyond the provisioning required under Basel III and more severe than the fastest bank runs experienced during the GFC. So why was this time different? My reading is the answer lay with the interaction of new technology and a different set of balance sheet vulnerabilities to those prevailing in the global financial crisis. Herding effects associated with social media present a new challenge for financial regulators here. And it's clearly easier to withdraw deposits at the stroke of a keyboard than it is to stand for hours in the rain outside a bank branch and bury the cash in the backyard. But I see the role of technology here more as an amplification mechanism, not a root cause per se. Note that the share of deposits that were uninsured had been steadily rising in the US banking system to the highest level since 1947. And for the three banks that failed in March, the share of uninsured deposits was more than double the system-wide average, between 89 and 94%. This might not have been an issue had these uninsured deposits been widely distributed among unconnected parties. The problem was they were concentrated in a small number of hands that were tightly connected via social media and industry linkages. More than half of Silicon Valley Bank's deposit base was sourced from companies in two sectors that were exposed to the same macro risk, and key account holders were closely connected in social and industry networks. Similarly, crypto asset clients accounted for almost 90% of the deposits of Silvergate Bank, almost all of which were uninsured and also exposed to the same risk, a crypto winter. The 10 largest depositors at Silvergate accounted for almost half of its deposit base. Part of the fear that spread through corporate deposit holders in the failed banks was not just related to the safety of their deposits, but also access to them. Businesses needed to make payroll, for instance. And in the case of Credit Suisse, key indicators of liquidity risk introduced under Basel III were relatively benign ahead of its deposit run. This was a dog that didn't bark, which is prompting reflection among policymakers everywhere. Stepping back, these events raise no shortage of policy issues. For instance, how should deposit flight assumptions be recalibrated for the digital age? How should interaction effects between uninsured bank deposits and concentrated deposit bases be accounted for? Should all banks be required to mark to market their liquid asset buffers? Should deposit insurance caps be lifted when uninsured deposits are held by so few depositors? And what would be the moral hazard implications? How best can continuous access to deposits be enabled in banks that are experiencing stress? And if banks choose to fund themselves with a high proportion of uninsured deposits that are more runnable, should they be required to pre-position collateral at the central bank so they're better placed to handle runs? It's impossible to do justice to these questions here other than to say that they're animating discussions among policymakers in Australia and internationally. Before moving on, I should note that the Australian banking system did not experience the stresses observed elsewhere. As the APRA chair recently observed, we don't have the same level of concentration risk or uninsured deposits in Australian banks, and our domestic liquidity and capital requirements generally more onerous. That said, there's no sense of complacency here. Our colleagues at APRA will soon be consulting on options for strengthening liquidity and interest rate risk management requirements. Let me now turn to a second inside risk, where systemic risks can arise from entities that may not be systemically important themselves. This means contagion risk is becoming more complex. In asking what's different now, my sense is that two amplification mechanisms have changed. First, the speed of money and information flows and related herding effects. And second, pro-cyclicality in parts of the international asset management industry. Money can now flow out of institutions and markets with unprecedented speed in response to the rapid spread of information and misinformation. In normal times, fewer frictions in the flow of money and information should lead to better economic outcomes. But the issue is more complex in stress periods. The ubiquity of social media, combined with 24/7 access to banking and payment services, and more globally connected trading platforms, raises the possibility that a shock somewhere in the financial system metastasizes into a broader self-fulfilling crisis of confidence. Concerns about rapid deposit runs enabled by technology have been building for decades, but social media has emerged as a new enabler of herding behaviour, especially when depositors are in close contact. Researchers have linked the unusual spike in social media activity not only to the fall of the regional banks in the US in March, but to the stress that was then subsequently experienced by other banks. Social media activity played a role in the stresses observed at Credit Suisse and Deutsche Bank over the past year. Institutions that are perceived to have broadly similar business models as those in stress seem particularly vulnerable in an environment of shoot first and ask questions later, especially when the shooting can happen faster than ever. A different amplification mechanism relates to pro-cyclicality in parts of the fast-growing international asset management industry. Investment funds operate with less intensive regulation and oversight compared with banks and don't have access to central bank liquidity or deposit insurance. Herding effects can be amplified when funds are tied to similar benchmarks, where they offer redemption terms to investors that cannot be easily satisfied in stress market conditions, asset fire sales can result. The periods of market dysfunction in key bond markets in early 2020 and 2021 were associated with this fire sale dynamic and saw a number of central banks compelled to respond. And the use of leverage can also be an accelerant of these illiquidity spirals, as evident in the UK gilt market meltdown September last year. While the makeup of the Australian financial system means we're not as directly exposed to these fire sale dynamics, our funding markets have been significantly disrupted by international events. The wider spillovers amplified by small banks and global investment funds in recent times raises a variety of issues. One is whether the bar for banks to be designated as systemic should be lowered. Another is how far regulators should go in imposing more onerous obligations on smaller banks, recognising that proportionality is central to regulatory design and that a regime that's unduly onerous could curtail the sort of competition and innovation that would otherwise benefit society. So there's a balance we've got to strike there. A more general issue is how resilience and recovery planning should better account for increased contagion risk. And in the case of investment funds, an ongoing issue is how best to mitigate the fire sale risks that can severely destabilise the functioning of critical financial markets. All of these issues are now under active international review. Let me now turn to the third inside risk, structurally higher interest rate volatility. For much of the past couple of decades, interest rate volatility declined, remained at unusually low levels. But there are a number of factors that could contribute to a regime shift characterised by structurally higher interest rate volatility in the years ahead. For a start, the Great Moderation is behind us. The global economy now appears more vulnerable to supply shocks, including from the rewiring of globalisation, geopolitical and political economy tensions, and energy shocks from climate change and related policies. Then there's the prospect of a higher and more volatile bond term premium. The term premium on bonds declined relentlessly for decades, reflecting declining uncertainty, coupled with structural supply-demand imbalances in bonds that meant that governments were able to issue debt with little or even negative term premium. But these trends are now turning around. And then there's also the declining influence of price-insensitive buyers in the bond market. Foreign exchange reserve managers have become net sellers in key global bond markets, including in US Treasuries. And central banks will be reducing their domestic bond holdings for years to come. Meanwhile, broker-dealers have reduced ability and willingness to bid for bonds during periods of heightened volatility. A period of structurally higher interest rate volatility will present challenges to financial system stability in a few ways. For a start, banks of all sizes will need to manage duration risk more intently. Inadequate management of interest rate risk was an important contributor to the US banking stresses in March. In Australia, banks tend to have modest exposure to securities compared with their global peers. Large banks are required to hold capital for interest rate risk in their banking book, and residual interest rate risk tends to be hedged. Nevertheless, this is an area of ongoing supervisory focus in many jurisdictions, including in Australia. The second issue is the interaction between credit risk and interest rate volatility. While credit risk was dampened over recent decades by the growth in incomes consistently exceeding the level of interest rates, debt servicing will become more challenging in an environment where interest rates periodically exceed the growth in incomes. And financial market functioning will also likely be challenged. The period after the global financial crisis of exceptionally low levels of interest rate and low interest rate volatility gave rise to a whole new generation of investment strategies, including those involving the leveraging up of bond positions. It remains to be seen how market functioning could be affected in a different regime for inflation and interest rate volatility. Let me now change gears and turn to three emerging risks to the financial system that are being generated from the outside, the first of which is geopolitical risk. Since the Second World War, the absence of direct conflict between economically integrated powers meant two generations of policymakers and industry participants could turn their attention elsewhere. This approach is no longer tenable. Fragmentation in the global economy will render it more prone to shocks. The IMF has suggested that global output losses of up to 7% could be possible, rising to 12% for some countries. A more strained geopolitical environment could also have material implications for the financial system and financial stability, not limited to the cross-border allocation of capital, international payment systems, key financial institutions, and global funding and commodity markets. As an organising framework, I think it's helpful to decipher the related geopolitical risks along two dimensions: slow burn fragmentation risk and fast burn kinetic risk. Slow burn fragmentation is arguably no longer a risk. It's already here. Trade and financial sanctions were increasing even prior to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Just-in-time efficiency is being traded off for strategic resilience in supply chains. Alternative payment messaging systems are being developed by some countries. Foreign exchange reserves are being shifted to countries and assets that are deemed less vulnerable to seizure. A smaller share of foreign direct investment, portfolio investment and bank credit is flowing between countries that are less aligned on foreign policy issues. It's now common to hear some countries characterised as uninvestable in a way that was not the case just a few years ago. And fraying support for international cooperation risks hampering operation of the global financial safety net. Aside from slow burn fragmentation, the second dimension I mentioned is fast burn kinetic risk, the risk that tensions escalate into conflict among countries that are critical to the operation of the global economy. Global financial stability risks increase along a continuum in this respect, depending on the scale, location, and countries involved. Events over the past couple of years give us a sense as to the main stress transmission channels. Global shipping could become uninsurable along certain routes. Global financial conditions could tighten abruptly, severely disrupting key funding markets, risky asset prices, and cross-border lending. Cross-border assets could be frozen or seized. Payment systems and financial market infrastructures could be affected by sanctions and counter-sanctions, and the risk of cyber attacks would heighten. Disruptions to commodity markets would be most significant where key trade routes are affected. And more generally, the longer that any conflagration persisted, the stronger the feedback loop between real and financial challenges at channels, including deteriorating asset quality for banks. The policy implications associated with heightened geopolitical risk are daunting and complex. So I'll simply note here the importance of building financial and operational resilience at both the domestic and international levels. At the international level, one key issue is to prevent the global financial safety net from splintering into smaller liquidity pools based on geopolitical blocks, right at the time when the call on global liquidity support could be increasing. Let me now turn to the second outside risk, operational risk. While the increasing digitalisation of financial sources has been a key source of innovation, it also means operational risk is now a first-order enterprise-wide risk. I'll focus on three of these risks, the most immediate of which is cyber. The scope for cyber attacks continues to increase, as do the consequences. Challenges are building from third-party technology dependencies, geopolitical tensions, and resourcing constraints among smaller institutions that could be key points of vulnerability for the wider financial system. Cyber attacks can result in direct financial losses from theft and ransom, and indirect losses arising from reputational damage. And the past year alone has borne this out in Australia and elsewhere. A multifaceted policy response is now rolling out. In Australia, the government recently established the role of the National Cybersecurity Coordinator to strengthen cybersecurity preparedness across the country. APRA has recently conducted a cybersecurity stocktake and finalised a new broader operational risk standard for its regulated entities. This will incorporate stronger requirements for maintaining and testing internal controls, improve business continuity planning, and enhancing institutions' oversight of external service providers. Regulators are also signifying an intent to undertake enforcement actions where firms fail to meet the expected standards of conduct. And the CORI framework, developed by the Council of Financial Regulators and led by the bank, continues to test the resilience of financial institutions to cyber attacks. All that said, this is an area where no amount of supervisory focus can substitute for robust planning and preparedness by financial institutions. A second operational risk relates to critical technology service providers that have been largely operating outside of the financial regulatory perimeter. Banks and financial market infrastructures are considering moving some services to the cloud, and this is typically for sound reasons. But exposure is concentrated in a select number of service providers, and an outage could leave many institutions unable to perform critical functions. Concerns about governance, risk management, platform concentration risk, and responsiveness in a crisis have also been raised in respect to the use of emerging technologies by financial institutions, including distributed ledgers. And in some jurisdictions, Australia included, big tech has sought to move into payment services without the regulatory oversight typically imposed on other financial service providers. A third operational risk, artificial intelligence, is no less challenging. AI offers some enormous opportunities, but managing the associated risks will not be straightforward. The risks relate to the potential for shocks in the financial system to be magnified. Contagion risk is one potential channel here, where parties could come to rely on similar models that are trained on similar data, using similar data aggregators and generating similar recommended actions, including in a crisis. And because the underlying models are complex and typically developed outside of the regulatory perimeter, system-wide vulnerabilities could be brewing in a way that is not obvious to either the financial institutions themselves or to supervisors. I'll now turn to the third and final risk, climate change. Risks to financial stability resulting from climate change and related policies will be with us for years to come. This is true for physical risks and for transition risks. These risks can result in unexpected losses for lenders, increased claims on insurers, and write-downs for investors, as we're now observing here in Australia and globally. Internationally, direct exposures to emissions-intensive businesses tend to be largest for investment funds, followed by insurers, and then the banks. As the Reserve Bank has previously set out the financial stability implications in Australia from climate change, I'll just briefly recap our main takeaways to date. Our preliminary analysis, along with that of APRA's, has found that banks would experience losses under different scenarios, but not of a magnitude that would cause significant stress. This is because lending losses appear concentrated in specific parts of the country and in specific industries that represent a fairly small proportion of banks' overall assets. Nevertheless, these early results need to be treated with caution as our understanding of climate-related financial risks is still developing. A particular focus going forward will be the household insurance sector. Payouts here have been rising in real terms for some time, and more frequent and severe weather events are expected to further increase claims on damaged property and other assets. Insurers can reset premiums quickly to recoup climate-related losses, or they could withdraw coverage altogether from high-risk regions and sectors. This would pass risk back to households, businesses, and or the government, or to lenders if loan defaults occur where affected assets serve as collateral. To better understand the risk to the financial system that could occur due to changes in the cost and coverage of insurance, APRA, on behalf of the Council of Financial Regulators, will soon be conducting a climate scenario analysis with insurers. The bank is also coordinating with CFR agencies on a set of priorities to support industry participants to manage their climate-related risks and opportunities. So let me wrap up. There are two common threads to the themes I've discussed today, and I'm conscious I've covered a lot of terrain. The first is that there are a number of emerging risks to financial stability that look quite different to those of recent decades and that will likely be with us for some time. Some have no historical precedent, and some of them could interact, and so are going to require particularly careful attention. Governance and risk management practices that have a strong forward-looking orientation will have a central role here. Think more scenario analysis, reverse stress testing, and less historical backtesting. The second thread is that building resilience along various dimensions is going to be critical, recognising, of course, that there are always trade-offs to be managed. Strength and resilience was the North Star for the reforms for large global and domestic banks following the global financial crisis. But for the financial system at large, there's more to do here. We can't know which risks will be realised or when, but we can be better prepared for whatever might come our way. Thank you.
We've got time for one or two questions of Brad. Just a reminder, though, that the RBA is under the blackout period at the moment, so no questions on monetary policy, please.
Okay.
But surely there's still some questions that that you want to ask. Who's going to go first?
Thanks, Brad. I'm a little depressed now. You describe, I guess, the challenges as different and persistent. What is your advice to the finance sector who have got immediate challenges and longer-term challenges to get this balance right when there's so many priorities? I mean, you talked about three sort of risk areas. What do you as the central bank expect the finance sector, banks and non-banks as a whole, to be thinking about now and over the coming months and years? We heard from Paul Bloxham this morning about, you know, headwinds globally still being a factor. Some opportunities for Australia in terms of different industries like renewables. What are you expecting from the finance sector at an aggregate and at an institutional level and at a customer level? And you've got 1 minute to answer the question.
I think Paul's right in that the next decade is going to offer some fantastic opportunities for the financial system in Australia and for the economy at large. It's the main message that I wanted to leave with you is those, you know, the flip side of those fantastic opportunities is that the risk environment is becoming more complex, more challenging, and I mean, we've got some conjunctural issues in front of us, but as I try to set out in my remarks, there are also a whole host of issues that are barreling down at us where just looking at historical data is going to be really of limited usefulness to help us prepare. So that's why I made the point at the end there about building program, risk management programs and running governance programs that are not so dependent on history repeating. My sense is that a lot of these challenges are going to be new. And it means that how we think about this concept of resilience is going to have to evolve. You know, the practices, standards of governance, the standards of risk management that have prevailed over the last 20 years are probably not going to be enough for the next decade. And so that means basically looking under the hood very intensively at how robust your business is to shocks of various kinds. I think a central tenet of risk management is sort of thinking backwards from, you know, if X event were to transpire, what would that mean for us? And I've laid out six risks here. I'm sure some of you here could probably come up with a few others. I mean, we recognise there's a trade-off here, of course. You can't just hide under the doona. That's kind of not, you know, that's not the message, because there will be some fantastic opportunities, particularly around innovation. But how we think about resilience for this new world, it needs to change. We need to be thinking much harder about it. And just one final point. At the bank, like I think most central banks, you know, we spend a lot of time looking at the aggregate data. One thing that's changed, enabled by better technology and better data, is that we and our fellow regulators now spending a lot more time looking at disaggregated data. Yes, we care about the aggregates. We also care about the distribution. And it's not enough that just the largest institutions to have the house in order. It's really imperative that everyone in the financial ecosystem is building a business model that's robust to shocks. That's going to be, I think, in the best interest of those institutions, those entities. It'll also be in the best interest of the financial system at large, because as we saw in March, you had a rupture in a number of small banks that most people around the world had never heard of, and yet those ruptures were sufficiently, you know, significant that it spilled over and became, for a period there, a global issue. So we're thinking very hard, I think much harder than possibly we're used to, about needing, about the imperative for smaller institutions to have very, very strong levels of governance and risk management, including around things like areas like operational risk, which maybe 10 years ago wasn't really on the radar.
Smart systems, using technology and data, alternative data sources to better understand and model, and smart humans thinking about that and being creative in the future.
Yeah, and thinking about scenarios. Right?
Humans and technology, though.
Yeah.
Not humans replaced by technology.
Indeed.
Got it.
Any other questions? No? All right, well, thank you so much, Brad.
Thank you.
Fantastic.